Hello, I'm Jason Mayoff. This is number 0192, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0192. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet actor Bill Mumy, best known as Will Robinson on Lost in Space. He talks about the new comic book, Curse of the Mumy, that he's writing, which features his likeness.
Blue Water Comics, the publisher Darren Davis called me up completely out of the blue, wanting to license my likeness and character for this sci-fi 60s kind of iconic universe he's got going with like Adam West and Vincent Price and Julie Newmar. And it's this fun kind of superhero, real crossover reality that he's created. And he wanted to license my stuff. And I said, well, let me think about this. Maybe I can come up with something. And the muse struck, and I had this true moment of inspiration, and now we've got a monthly comic book coming out.
Stephen Paul Leyva is an author. He's back on the program to talk about his latest book, Searching for Ray Bradbury, a collection of essays he wrote about the science fiction icon who was a good friend and mentor.
He was a forward-thinking guy, and if you really read his writing, you discover a depth there that the gloss of his larger-than-life personality can kind of outshine sometimes. So I basically came to the conclusion in my essay that I will now miss Ray. I spent a lot of time with him in the last several years of his life. We would joke together, we would talk about old movies, and I'll dearly miss that, but I realized as long as his writing is there and I go back and read his writing, I'll never miss him, and indeed I'll be probably closer to him than I ever was.
David Michaels is the senior executive producer of the Daytime Emmy broadcast. They're partnering with the Smithsonian for a new exhibit.
It's a very big deal. NATIS, the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, is thrilled to partner with an organization as classy as the Smithsonian. It's also very exciting to us that they understand the legacy of daytime television, so that, you know, they're doing renovations there right now. And when the new wing is ready, this one of the exhibits is American culture, and one section of that will definitely be the legacy of daytime television. So we're just thrilled not only that they're doing it with us, but that they're doing it at all.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0192, was Jason Mayoff, the news anchor at CJAD Radio in Montreal. Thank you very much, Jason, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. And by the way, you can check out Jason's website. It's easy to find. First of all, there's a link on the Stuff File page on the What's On page for this show, which, as Jason just mentioned a little while ago, is number 0192. And it's his name, so it's easy to find. JasonMayoff.com. Again, thank you very much, Jason, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Much appreciated. A program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, the United Nations says more people have cell phones than toilets. About 6 billion of the planet's population of 7 billion have mobile phones, but only 4.5 billion have access to basic sanitation. The biggest culprit appears to be India. Of its 1.2 billion citizens, about half have a mobile phone, but only about a third have a working toilet. The irony here, of course, is that of the 6 billion mobile subscribers, at least two-thirds have said at some point that their phone service is crap. So, there you go. And of course, I'll be long dead in about 50 years, but the cancer statistics at around that time should simply be astounding, don't you think? Anyway, 3 years ago, at a party at his home, Billy McNeely, who's now 32, was in an arm wrestling contest that got out of hand. A fight broke out, and McNeely was stabbed 5 times. They stitched me up and bandaged me up, he said, but one wound never quite properly healed. It itched and had a lump. Damaged nerves, doctors told him. But after 3 years of itching as well as setting off metal detectors at airports. A small fragment of the blade stuck in a bone, doctors then told him. I sat up, I tried to rub it, and scratch it away, and scratch it the way I always did, and then the tip of my nail caught a piece of something solid, something sharp, McNeely said. It was the 2 3/4-inch blade. Let me repeat that. The 2 3/4-inch blade. He is now considering suing the doctors. Okay. I don't want to belittle this guy when it comes to the idea of wanting to sue the doctors, because, you know, he has a point. Actually, a point he wants to get rid of, but I digress. But here's what concerns me. He's really angry with the guys who left the blade in there. That's the cause of his lawsuit. I don't see him complaining about the person who put it in there. All he gets is an indifferent shrug. You know, maybe his anger's a little misplaced here. Okay, to counter the now well-publicized culture of rape in India, 3 engineers said in March that they are about to send to the market women's anti-rape lingerie. Yes, I'm not making that up, folks, seriously. That's actually in the news. 3 Indian engineers are coming up with this. Now, this undergarment will provide both a stun gun-sized blast of electricity against an aggressor and a messaging system sending GPS location to family members and the police about an attack in progress. After the wearer engages a switch, anyone touching the fitted undergarment will, as said one developer, get, quote, the shock of his life, unquote, even though the garment's skin side will be insulated. The only marketing holdup, according to the March report in the Indian Express, is finding a washable fabric. Now, seriously, have we come to this now in India? Basically an electric chastity belt? Wouldn't it be easier to toughen the laws and perhaps learn to treat women like human beings? Or is that just asking too much? Anyway, where was I? Oh, yes. Okay. I say that about the story in India, but let's get back to the United States with this next story that returns to objectifying women. Hot tip for busty ladies who like to drive angry: don't hide your assets. Police say a woman rammed a man's car in San Francisco during an argument over a parking spot. The fiery driver most likely will never be caught, however, since her alleged victim could not describe any of her features except her breasts, according to police. The make of the woman's car and its license plate number also escaped his attention, courtesy of her low-cut dress. Police say the man was only able to give a detailed description of the suspect's cleavage. Not just a description, a detailed description. Hey, San Francisco, Police Academy wants its script back. Wow. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, aspiring rap music big shot Bernard Bay, aged 32, filed a $200,000 lawsuit in February in New York City against his parents, alleging that they owe him because they have been unloving and indifferent to his homelessness and refused even to take him back in to get a shower. Bay, who raps as Brooklyn Streets, says everything would be forgiven if they would just buy him 2 Domino Pizza franchises so that he could eventually earn enough to become a force to be reckoned with in the hip-hop community. He doesn't want just one Domino's pizza franchise. He wants 2. And this 32-year-old wants mommy and daddy to pay for it. His mother's solution, as told to a New York Daily News reporter, go get a job. He never had a job a day in his life. You go, Mom. I don't think it's a big stretch to go out on a limb and call Brooklyn Streets a loser. A monumental loser. The only bigger loser? The lawyer who filed this ridiculous lawsuit. Anyway, let's move on to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Yes, let's do that. Actor, musician, and writer Bill Mumy, best known for iconic roles such as young Will Robinson in the classic sci-fi TV show Lost in Space and Lanier in Babylon 5, is being immortalized in comic form with the release of the new monthly comic book Curse of the Mumy. It's published by Blue Water Comics. The first one has just been released, and Bill Mumy joins us on the line from California. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So now you're, as I said, you're immortalized in comic form, and you're playing yourself in the comic, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Blue Water Comics, the publisher Darren Davis called me up completely out of the blue, wanting to license my likeness and character for this sci-fi 60s kind of iconic universe he's got going with like Adam West and Vincent Price and Julie Newmar. And it's this fun kind of superhero real crossover reality that he's created. And he wanted to license my stuff, and I said, well, let me think about this. Maybe I can come up with something. And the muse struck, and I had this true moment of inspiration, and now we've got, you know, a monthly comic book coming out. And it does indeed involve around me in reality prime and then activating these characters that I had created over the course of a career now, into real beings.
At what age are you in the comic?
Well, I run from the age of 6 to now.
Wow. So the full gamut.
I take it you haven't read number 1 yet.
I have not seen number 1 yet, no.
Well, there you go. Yes. I run the gamut of ages in the book because I the curse of the Mumy is that I have the ability to activate avatars, in essence, of the characters that I've played and bring them to real life. But every time I use that ability to activate one of those characters, then I lose a random piece of myself, like a memory. So you never know what it could be. It could be a small little thing, like where did I leave my keys? Or it could be like forgetting a family member ever existed. It's the curse of the Mumy.
Now, you mentioned that you let your muse guide you as to how this was going to go. But how much input do you have in what goes into the comic?
100%, without trying to, you know, act like I'm drawing it. But, Blue Water Comics called to license me, and I ended up just writing the book. So, I mean, I've written the book. It's based on my likeness, and, I have approval of the artwork, and Ron Stewart's doing a fantastic job. What I wanted to do was tell a big story, but that was character-driven in a early Silver Age style of comic book storytelling with a early Golden Age artwork style, wrapped up with some modern humor and sexuality. But nothing that, nothing say that would be R-rated, let's put it that way.
Okay.
Nothing you wouldn't see on primetime TV, but in today's world. I have pretty much complete control. I mean, I've written 8 issues already, and I haven't gotten any notes. So I think that's a good thing.
Absolutely. Are you yourself a big comic book fan?
Yes.
And
yes. I mean, my earliest memories are of reading comic books, and I have, a massive collection of comic books that goes back to the early Golden Age, and that's a passion of mine. And I started writing for Marvel Comics back in the mid-80s, and I've written for DC and Dark Horse and many other publishers, and it's an arena of show business that I love to work in. I just hadn't been doing it much for the last decade. So this call out of the blue just kind of, woke up that creative spark of comic book writing Mumy.
Would you say this is becoming a sort of golden age of comic books again with the advent of what people now like to call graphic novels?
No.
No, not at all?
No. Well, first of all, graphic novels go back to let's say in terms of modern popular culture, like big publishers, they go back to the 80s. So it's nothing new. But no, I don't feel like comic books are at a golden age, actually. I feel like there are these incredible characters that, could really use a better helping hand to tell their stories most of the time. I'm a bit disappointed in what I read every month, but I buy all the books. I mean, I read a ton of comic books every month. I just I don't think that they're all in great hands. Some of them are.
Do you know, you say you've already written eight. This is going to be coming
right.
monthly.
Eight are finished.
Eight are scripted.
Three are finished with artwork, but you know, the artist is, as I said, Ron Stewart, a really good guy, really delivering the goods here. He's you know, about to start book number four.
Do you know long term where the comic version of Bill Mumy is going, or are you learning this, or are you learning where the character is going as you go along?
Well, let's put it this way. I'm not interested in killing myself off. You know, I don't think I'll be doing any serious damage. I don't know. I really don't know where. You know, the thing about a comic book, which is so great, is, you know, you have every special effect and very small budget to do it. You know, you can create anything you want in a comic book. So I have no idea where the next arc will go. The first two arcs, which are both four-story issues to basically tell these two big stories, you know, the first eight issues are like two four-story arcs. I'm not sure where we'll go from there. Where would you? Well, you got to read it, and then you can tell me where you'd like to see it go.
Exactly. Which is something, by the way, I definitely do plan to do. I will.
There you go.
Which brings me to the next question. How does one get their hands on Curse of the Mumy?
Oh, well, I guess I should be more prepared for that question. You know, it's Kindle and Nook and iTunes and Amazon and at any comic book store that orders it. And there are links on, you know, if you look up Curse of the Mumy, Blue Water Comics, there's all sorts of links to click on it, and I'm sure you can get it in print form or computer form or, you know, any kind of format that you want right away. I think that it's pretty easy to do. I haven't done it yet. I don't have one. I actually don't have one of the comics yet. I have it in my computer, but I don't have an actual comic book yet. I'm waiting too.
Now, when I asked about the golden age of comics, you say this is not it. You did write for comics before. You took a bit of a, I guess it's a 12-year hiatus from writing comics?
Yeah, I guess that's about right. I think it's about 12 years since I was writing comic books.
So what, if any way, would you say comics have changed in that decade plus?
Yeah, well, they've gotten more expensive, and they've also... It seems like the editing tends to... I catch a lot of typos in comic books. You never caught typos in comic books in the 60s or 50s or 40s. Maybe it started in the 70s, I guess, but not that much. But I catch a lot of mistakes in comic books that a good editor would never have let slide in the past. I just don't think there's a great abundance. That's not to say that I don't think some people working in the industry are truly inspired great artists or great writers. I do. But I think in terms of the general playing field, there's a lot of mediocre talent out there right now handling great characters that, you know, will simply wait them out. You know, it's like the Lakers. It might not be a good season for the Lakers, but, you know, the Lakers will be back. So if you're not digging Superman right now, Superman, I'm sure, will come around to your style. And, you know, you just got to give the character time and a chance to find its right creative team. Now, and what's right for me might not be right for somebody else either. You know, I mean, it's all subjective.
You're keeping busy with this comic book, Curse of the Mumy. You also still do your music. I understand you have an album coming out later on this year.
That's right. Finishing up another solo album called Illumination. So that'll be on GRA. And we're looking at a June or July release on that. It depends on when I get a handful of videos in the can. We're trying to have some videos in the can before the release of this particular project.
What about work in front of the screen? Any plans there?
No, not really. I do a lot of voiceover work, and I love that. Doing some animation next week and narration, some commercial stuff. I haven't really been going out much for on-camera work for the last 5 or 6 years. It's kind of, to me, I really enjoy that process of work, but I don't really enjoy that process of looking for work. So it's like, if it comes my way, which it might, then that's a good thing, and I would embrace that. But I'm not really looking hard for that.
I know.
It's a weird world out here in Hollywood, trying to get a gig on a, you know, television show or a small little film or something. That industry has changed much more than the comic book industry. And, you know, I'm not driven to compete in that arena. I like working in that arena, but it doesn't, you know, motivate me to beat the boards, so to speak.
I hear you. Well, the new comic is called Curse of the Moomy, and people can find it on various places, as you mentioned, online. And people can also find out more information by going to your website, which is BillMoomy.com, correct?
That is correct, and I'm on Facebook, and people can follow me there, like the Pied Piper. I'm past a certain number of, like, friends, but you can follow my page, and I enjoy posting on Facebook. So, yeah, this new social media thing, it's getting kind of lost in space-ish.
And we've come back around full circle, haven't we?
Bada-bing!
Bill, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
My pleasure. Have a nice evening.
Bill Moomy. His new comic book is Curse of the Moomy. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0192, and you'll find links to Bill's site, plus links to Amazon.com, where you can order the comic directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we have another visit with my good friend Stephen Paul Leyva, the author. He talks about his good friend, the late Ray Bradbury, and his latest book, not Ray's, Steve's. It's called Searching for Ray Bradbury. Also, we'll meet the senior executive producer of the Daytime Television Emmys. That's coming up in a little bit. Plus, of course, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. And lots more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, a Long Island, New York woman bought a BB gun, then drove her two children and another boy around with them to shoot at parked cars. 43-year-old, yes, a grown woman, 43-year-old Susan Becker was arrested. Police said there were more than 60 reports of damage to car windows over the past 2 weeks. Police say Becker's 13-year-old son and 15-year-old daughter and another 15-year-old boy were involved. Becker was facing several charges, including endangering the welfare of a child. News of her arrest came as a shock to one neighbor. Susan's a great mom. She's a great neighbor. She's always there to help anybody and everybody. This according to neighbor Susan Morelli. A very all-American type mom. I just can't say enough nice things about her because she's just such a nice person. Morelli said there must be some explanation that we don't know about. She just wouldn't do something like that. Well, I'll go out on a limb with the explanation and say that she's just out of her flipping mind. Yeah, that one works for me. And by the way, she's not Mom of the Year, okay? She's just not. Anyway, on to France. Okay, this is the type of story that I keep coming across every couple of years, and it still keeps happening. Here's the latest edition. The remains of a woman believed to have died in 2010 has been discovered in her Toulouse, France apartment. Now, firefighters and police entered the apartment of Fernande Braca, who was in her 70s. They found her a week ago Thursday. Neighbors described her as quiet and solitary. Now, there's an understatement. And said that she only left her residence to go shopping. Although financial statements and other mail piled up on her doorstep, neighbors assumed she had moved away. Her rent and utility bills were being paid electronically. One neighbor said, "When I noticed her windows were closed after a while, I thought she had gone to live in a retirement home." A preliminary medical examination indicated Braca died 3 years ago, although no cause of death was identified. So I have to ask you, when was the last time you saw your elderly neighbor? Yeah, I'm just saying. Carol, a 39-year-old circus elephant, wounded in a drive-by shooting, is expected to make a full recovery. When was the last time you heard the sentence, "Carol, a circus elephant, wounded in a drive-by shooting"? That doesn't come up very often, does it? Yeah, okay. She was shot on the grounds of the Bancorp South Arena in Tupelo, Mississippi, while on tour with The Greatest Show on Earth. It appeared to be a deliberate, targeted event, said Captain Rusty Haynes with the Tupelo Police. Yeah, because how many accidental shootings of elephants do you know of? Authorities are looking for a silver or white Ford Explorer that was seen in the area at the time of the shooting. Haynes said Carol, an Asian elephant, was struck in her neck, or on her neck rather, between her shoulder and ear. A reward for information leading to an arrest and conviction in the case has climbed to $24,000. A part of that money is coming from the U.S. government, as Asian elephants are endangered. You know, that shooter better be laying low, because you know what they say, an elephant never forgets. O.B. Cargyle, age 71, was pulled over by Lincoln Heights, Ohio, for improper brake lights on his truck. "They'd been on there for 10 years, and I'd been all over the country with it," Cargyle said. Still, he was fined $160 plus $105 in court costs. Court costs were waived when Cargyle objected, but he was told to pay or go to jail for 3 days. "I said, what the hell? I can do this easy, standing on my head," said Cargyle. He took the jail time to protest the infraction and the fine, and because spending time in jail was on his bucket list of things to do before he dies. What an interesting bucket list that must be. And it wasn't that bad. "It was a picnic. An unadulterated picnic," Cargyle said. "I'm 70 years old. What am I going to do?" He said the experience gave him insight into the legal and jail systems, and he got to make his point. "Oh, yes, it was worth it," he said. "I had a good time." Wow. You know, you can go anywhere with a positive attitude, even places you don't want to go. You go, Obi. You go. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, two Braddock, Pennsylvania police officers got into an argument over what Mayor John Fetterman called something stupid. The argument quickly escalated and turned physical until one officer fired a taser at the other. Both officers drove home that night and neither went to the hospital, but both are suspended pending an investigation. Fetterman said both are good officers with no problems in their history, and he hoped this incident didn't tarnish the work that they and the rest of the department have done. Fetterman notes that, quote, "They've gone 5 years now in our community without a murder in town." Well, bully for you. Though if they get one anytime soon, they might want to question the officers. Yeah. So these are the good cops on the force, huh? Kind of makes you wonder and want to meet some of the morons in the group. Yee. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Writer Stephen Paul Leyva is back on the program. He has a new book out called Searching for Ray Bradbury, a series of essays written between 2009 and 2012. Of course, Ray Bradbury was a science fiction master who died at the age of 90, and Ray was a great friend and mentor of Steve. And Steve is on the line with us right now from California to tell us about the book and share some of his memories of Ray. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Peter Anthony, or as I like to call you, Pete Tony.
Thanks for being on the program with us. I know you were close to Ray. We've often talked about your association with Ray. What made you put this book out?
Well, I've been writing... Well, it goes back to a time when I was asked by the head of the Buffalo International Film Festival to videotape Ray giving an introduction and a greeting to the audience for his film festival, because he was planning to show a 3D version of It Came From Outer Space, which was the first film that Ray was ever involved in. And Ray, at that point, his health just wouldn't allow him to go back to Buffalo to be there in person. So he asked me if I could just videotape him doing a greeting. So I grabbed my best friend, Peter Lonsdale, who's a film editor and also a great camera bug, and we ran down to Ray's and we filmed him doing that. And then with Peter at the helm, he put together a really, really nice video, more than just Ray talking. It had graphics and what have you. And that just got me to thinking, spending that time with Ray, about our friendship and about how much he meant to me, and the fact that he was one of the three authors I read as a young man who made me want to become a writer. Besides Ray, there was W. Somerset Maugham and Ian Fleming, author of the James Bond novels. So I wrote an essay, which I submitted to the Los Angeles Times, and they thought it would be best on their blog, a very famous blog called Hero Complex, which is about all things genre, science fiction, comic books, and things like that. And so it first appeared there, and that was called Searching for Ray Bradbury. And because of that, that led me through a process which is too long to explain now, but is in my book, to do Ray Bradbury Week in Los Angeles, a week-long series of events honoring Ray on his 90th birthday. And all this just kept popping up that I was writing different essays about Ray. And then, of course, he died last year, which was upsetting to many of us. I suppose it wasn't unexpected, but we all kind of thought he would go on forever. And that meant some more essays, including a memorial piece I wrote for the science fiction writers magazine called The Bulletin. And then one day I suddenly realized I had about 8 of these, and wouldn't they make a nice little book? So I called my publisher, I suggested it, he said, yeah, let's do it. And that's how the book Searching for Ray Bradbury is now in existence.
Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, not only was he a friend, but he was also a mentor of yours, and you followed him. You read his stuff, as you say, as a young man. What was it like for you getting to meet Ray Bradbury and, more importantly, getting to know him?
Well, it was funny because when I met him, we met because of animation. It was back in it was 77, and I was at that time executive secretary of an animators organization called ASIFA, which is an international organization, but I was executive secretary of the Los Angeles branch. And the president of that branch was Rocky the Flying Squirrel, otherwise known as June Foray, the voice actress. And she came up with a bright idea to raise money for the organization of selling animation sales, which no one had ever done before. And I met him at one of those sales we put on, which I helped organize. And I was he was wonderful because his uniform basically was tennis shorts, a tennis shirt, and a tennis jacket. And he went everywhere in those, unless it was a really formal affair. And I was thrilled to meet him. And then later, because of animation, I kept running into him because he was a good friend of Chuck Jones, who at the time, later I started doing publicity for. And then we were involved on a film together, a co-production between Gary Kurtz's company. Gary had produced Star Wars and American Graffiti, and a Japanese company. So it was a big international co-production, and Ray had been tapped to write the screenplay. But during all this time, I was dealing with him on that professional level, and I never wanted to act like a fan, and I never told him how important he had been to me, because I just felt that it wasn't proper, that you just didn't act that way when you were going together on a professional basis. But he was such a font of energy, enthusiasm, and positiveness that you would just stand by him and bask in that. He would, when we were on Nemo, I was the associate producer. I basically was in charge of the whole American end of the production. And for the first year, we were in America with Japanese artists and American artists trying to develop the film. And Ray would come in to talk to our artists, to have meetings with them. And he'd come in and he'd burst into my office, and he'd always burst in with a statement. I mean, that's how he entered a room. He didn't enter a room. He burst into a room. And he'd always make some kind of a statement as he walked in. And I remember one time it was, "People send me metaphors in the mail. Isn't that wonderful?" And we all said, "Yeah, that's great." And then one time he burst in and said, "I just came back from a writer's conference, and I told everybody, you don't have to read Saul Bellow," which I was reading a novel by Saul Bellow at that moment. So I found that oddly disconcerting, because a writer I really, really admire was telling me not to read another writer who I also liked. But there was a reason behind that, and I explore that in one of the essays in my book, because it had to do with the growth of Ray as a writer in his young days, which at that time I knew nothing about, but now, because of a wonderful biography on him called Becoming Ray Bradbury by Jonathan Eller, which I a review of mine of that book is in my book of essays, really charts his growth as an artist from his teen years until his late 20s, early 30s. It's a wonderful book.
You had an opportunity to work with him later in life, of course, and do these events that you alluded to earlier. As he progressed, as he aged, was he aware, or was he at all concerned about the impact he had had on so many people, yourself included?
Oh, he was totally aware of it and delighted by it, but not really in an egocentric way. It was a joy to him because he wanted to spread the joy. He did not like modernist fiction that was more of a downer, if we can put it any other way. And he charted his own course. And through his writing and through his public appearances and through his television appearances, especially during the first moon landings, he was on probably on ABC or NBC as a guest commentator during the various moon landings in the late 60s, early 70s. People got to know this larger-than-life Ray Bradbury. And when he would give a speech, it was stunning. He was so inspirational. He would get a standing ovation upon appearance, and he would get a standing ovation when he left the stage. And he never spoke from prepared notes. It was always extemporaneous as his mind took him, which is how he would first write. He always wrote in sort of an improvisational manner, just letting it all out. But I can't tell you how many people have told me that seeing him changed their lives. And that was true with me. And what I discovered, and when I wrote my last piece in the book, which I wrote for the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America for their publication called The Quarterly, which was the memorial piece, this was after Ray died, it became clear to me that I had sort of gotten to know the larger-than-life Ray. And I hadn't read as much of his writing as I had when I was younger, and I realized that I wasn't getting the real Ray. So I went back and reread some works and started reading some work, because, you know, hundreds and hundreds of short stories, so there's a lot to read. And I also directed a staged reading with James Cromwell of Ray's short play called The Better Part of Wisdom, which is not anywhere near a piece of science fiction. It's actually a piece declaring that love is what's important. It's a piece written in the early 70s, inspired by his time in Ireland in the 50s, and it was about homosexuality. And its point was simply, none of that matters, whether it's heterosexual or homosexual. What matters is there love involved? Which was a dynamite thing for him to have written in the early 70s, because at that time, I mean, and it takes place in England, homosexuality was just become legalized in England, but it was still obviously not considered proper. So he was a forward-thinking guy, and if you really read his writing, you discover a depth there that the gloss of his larger-than-life personality can kind of outshine sometimes. So I basically came to the conclusion in my essay that I will now miss Ray. I spent a lot of time with him in the last several years of his life. And I dearly miss those times. We would joke together. We would talk about old movies. Whenever I would say goodbye, I would give him a little kiss on the top of his head, because, of course, he could not stand at that point. He was in a chair or in his bed. And I'll dearly miss that, but I realize as long as his writing is there and I go back and read his writing, I'll never miss him, and indeed I'll be probably closer to him than I ever was in the physical sense.
How does one get their hands on your book, Searching for Ray Bradbury?
It is at the moment a paperback available through Amazon and Amazon UK and I think some of the other Amazon European sites. It is a small book. It comprises the 8 essays and about 19 photos, which I think people will find interesting. It's only $5.99. It will be Kindleized pretty soon, and then I hope later it'll go on to the other ebook formats. But that's basically it. Amazon.com or Amazon.uk or wherever you are, and you'll see it there.
Steve, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for sharing your insights into Ray Bradbury.
Thank you, Peter. I truly appreciate it. And I will just give you a last line that Ray always said, do what you love and love what you do.
Author Stephen Paul Leyva. His latest book is Searching for Ray Bradbury. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0192, and you'll find links to Steve's site, plus links to Amazon.com, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Several years ago, a California teenager decided to throw chunks of concrete off a highway overpass. One chunk, weighing 2.5 pounds, crashed through the windshield of a truck and landed on the driver. Sadly, he went into a coma and later died. The teenager was convicted of assault with a deadly weapon. In a case like this, a lawsuit is certainly reasonable. But who the victim's lawyer sued will surprise you. He sued the company that made the truck. That's right, the lawyer argued that the windshield should have been able to withstand a 2.5 pound chunk of concrete. However, during the trial, the jury heard that the windshield complied with all federal safety standards, so they ruled in favor of the truck company. Let's be fair, justice would have been served, but recently, a divided court of appeals reinstated the lawsuit, and many are again wondering what has happened to common sense in our courts. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And The Stuff File program is heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And if you haven't got the Stitcher app, it's very easy to find. Just simply go to Stitcher.com and you can download it. It's free. You can also go to any app store. It's also free there too. And once you have the Stitcher app, you can listen to this show and 15,000 other programs on your mobile device. Want to say a quick shout out to a good buddy of mine who is Detlef Schmalhaus, who's probably ironing while listening to the show while we speak, because he's always ironing. We're going to bury him with that iron. Hello there, Daddy. We have an idiot of the day coming up in just a matter of moments here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. But we do have time for one more guest. We're running out of time, but we have one more guest on the program, and let's get to him right now. The Smithsonian is currently preparing the new Daytime Television History exhibit in association with the 40th anniversary of the Daytime Emmy Awards. The facility will honor all genres of daytime TV, from dramas to game shows to children's programming, talk shows, and more. To talk a little about this is David Michaels, who was the senior executive producer of the Daytime Emmy broadcast. And by the way, the 40th annual Daytime Emmys will be on the air on June 16th on HLN. David joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, David.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, it's hard to believe it's 40 years that the Daytime Emmys have been around, because I remember the first one, so there you go. I'm beginning to feel old already.
Do you?
Yeah, but you,
yeah, no, it's very exciting. I mean, other than just the fact that it's a 40th anniversary, there's just so much iconic material and emotion behind it, and we really, really feel that we're going to be able to take this broadcast and look back over the over the 40 years. And our theme is kind of to talk about the past, the present, and the future of daytime television.
Well, that brings us to an interesting point. What do you see the future of daytime television is? Because, you know, you go back over the 40 years and you look at the rich past. And one of the things that's part of the rich past, for instance, is daytime dramas. And there are very few of those anymore.
Well, you know, daytime dramas are definitely a big part of it. We have, you know, four of them left on the air. And interestingly, their ratings are only getting better and better and better and better. The popularity is most certainly not waning. And I'm sure you read about and heard about the outcry when the other two were canceled. And I'm sure you've also heard that they are coming back as web series. So, but as far as daytime television, aside from the soaps that are very much alive, there's an amazing surge of talk shows, and game shows are back, and culinary shows are huge, and court shows are huge. So there's so much daytime television in addition to the daytime dramas that it's really alive and well and thriving.
So let's talk a little bit about the Smithsonian event that's taking place in conjunction with the 40th anniversary of the Daytime Emmy Awards. This is a very big deal, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very big deal. You know, NATIS, the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, is thrilled, you know, to partner with an organization as classy as the Smithsonian. And it's also very exciting to us that they understand the legacy of daytime television, so that, you know, they're doing renovations there right now. And when the new wing is ready, there's one of the exhibits is American culture. And one section of that will definitely be the legacy of daytime television. So we're just thrilled not only that they're doing it with us, but that they're doing it at all, you know.
What kinds of things besides just, for instance, old tapes of old shows, what kinds of things will physically be there that represent the history of daytime television?
Well, we're doing a little kickoff event in May, and then we're also going to, you know, talk about it on the broadcast, on the Emmy broadcast. When we go down there in May, Susan Lucci's coming with us. And she's going to be giving us, we have a cover of People magazine that came out the day after she won her Emmy. And that's the whole cover is her and the Emmy. And she's giving us the dress that she's wearing on the cover. And she's giving us a script, one of her personal scripts from the from All My Children. And Alex Trebek is coming, and he's bringing us if you watch Jeopardy, you know how he makes his pencil marks after he asks a question?
Yes.
He's giving us the script from the very, very first episode with his pencil marks on it. And he's giving them also some other graphic cards and parts of the Jeopardy set that preceded going totally digital like it is now. So things like that are, they're pieces of history.
I think back, you look, for instance, at nighttime television. Let's use The Tonight Show, for instance, with Johnny Carson. And they always lament that the early years of Johnny Carson's reign on that show have been lost because no one bothered to keep any of the tapes. Is it a similar situation with the treasures for daytime television that quite a bit of it is lost because people didn't think to save it?
I think that's the case. I think that is definitely the case sometimes. And also, I think there are other times, like with this stuff from Jeopardy, where somebody had the foresight. Well, somebody might ask for this day. Because, they have such amazing things at the museum. I mean, Howdy Doody is there, you know, himself. I'm fascinated by, they have, of course, going out of daytime TV, they have Dorothy's ruby slippers from The Wizard of Oz. They have the most amazing things. You can just spend hours with your jaw dropping. So we hope to make a few more jaws drop by what we're going to find for them.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the Daytime Emmys, which again is coming up on June 16th on the HLN. I know that you're going to be honoring a couple of people near and dear to my heart. One is a Canadian. And the other...
Oh, really?
Yeah, one is a Canadian who is Monty Hall. And and the other is a legendary producer of what is my all-time favorite game show, which is the $20,000 Pyramid, Bob Stewart.
It's funny. I was the producer of that show for all the years that it was in California, so this is near and dear to my heart. Monty Hall, of course, you know, he's an icon. It speaks for itself. You know, he's an on-camera personality. But, you know, with Bob Stewart, few people know. I mean, he created not only Pyramid, but he created Password. He created The Price is Right. He created To Tell the Truth. So, I mean, very few people have a legacy in daytime television like Bob. And unfortunately, we lost him about a year and a half ago. But his son is going to accept the award.
Excellent. How has it been for the Daytime Emmys? Because last year, I believe, was the first year you were on HLN, right?
Yes.
How was that association?
And it was a wonderful relationship. We're very, very, very happy to be continuing it. It was very widely viewed. And they're an amazing publicity machine. They just did an amazing job last year. And we're expecting even more this year. We really expect this to be something very special.
40 years, you're honoring the work that has been done in television in the past in daytime. But, of course, people always look forward towards the future. In your estimation, someone who's been in television for a long period of time, what excites you about the future of daytime television?
The fact that it's ever evolving, the fact that so many of the shows now have internet components where the fans can either, you know, find out more or have some kind of interaction with it. And, you know, I think the whole online experience is a big part of the future of television. But, you know, we even have a few categories, to honor those online components. And I think that as the years go on, there's going to be even more. And like I said, it's very significant that two major daytime dramas are now exclusively going to be seen on the internet. So it kind of points toward where we're going.
Mm. I'm just curious, for future Emmy shows, would shows that go on the web and are not on television, would they still be eligible for Emmys?
Well, you know, that's under discussion. My quick answer would be yes. It's just, you know, how are we going to restructure it so that we, the Emmy people, can keep up with the changing technology and the changing way that things are presented. But, it's television. Television's really telecommunications. And so anything that is broadcast is most certainly, you know, considered part of this contest. So we have one category, which is short form series, which is all internet. And it has all kinds of programming. There's stuff for kids. There's there are short form daytime dramas. It's ever evolving.
The 40th annual Daytime Emmys will air on HLN on the 16th of June. And also the other event that's taking place, which is, I believe, on May the 9th at the Smithsonian.
That's not a televised event, but
exactly.
That's the event where we're bringing Susan Lucci and Alex Trebek, and we're going to kind of kick off this partnership for real. And then we will have a segment on the broadcast where we also kind of announce it to the world. The event in May will not be televised, but it's a press event, so it should get a lot of coverage. And we're very, like I said, just very excited, and I get to go to Washington and see the cherry blossoms, and it's all good.
Sounds like it's going to be a good time, and I look forward to seeing snippets of it when the 40th annual Daytime Emmys airs on HLN in June on the 16th. I thank you very, very much, David, for being on the program with us.
Well, thank you so much, Peter. I hope to talk to you again.
David Michaels, senior executive producer of the Emmy broadcast. Again, the 40th annual Daytime Emmys will be on the air on June 16th on HLN. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Who would expect to see a trooper sitting in the parking lot of a state police barracks, said Lieutenant Stephen Jones, about three men sitting in their car outside the barracks in Passaic County, New Jersey. From the sounds of this, they were certainly surprised. Isaias Parellas, age 22, Hensley Nunez, age 21, and Bernardo Cuevas, age 23, were waiting in the parking lot as their friend Tamir Abdulrahim, age 22, was inside trying to get a release of his impounded car. When Trooper Eric Tapia pulled into the parking lot, he smelled marijuana and followed his nose to the car where the men were waiting. Several troopers came out to back him up and search the car, where they found plenty of pot and other drugs. Cuevas and Parilla had warrants and were arrested. Nunez was cited and released. And Abdulrahim probably started work on getting a release for yet another impounded car. Okay, why would three looped-out guys who are carrying copious amounts of drugs hang out in the parking lot of the state police barracks while their friend was inside trying to get a release of his impounded car? One reason, and one reason only. They're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0192. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, it's 0192. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberstationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. Oh, God. I always screw it up.